Anyway, this ceremony where we celebrate the enlightenment of the Buddha, kind of, you know, and the significance of a Buddha is the fact that the Buddha actually is the one who actually both realized the truth, but realized in a way that he could teach others how to do it. You know, there's, which isn't automatic. And the Buddha was a very skilled teacher. It's why we have all these traditions in Buddhism saying, do this, do that. Yet when you read the scriptures, the Buddha did a lot of different things. And when people would say, well, shouldn't everyone do this or that? He would say, no, we're all different. And, you know, and that's why it's not like there's... But the essence of the teaching, like the first teaching he gave right after his enlightenment with the Four Noble Truths, you know, that life is not satisfactory. You know, that if you really look, you're uncomfortable. Not with everything, but with a lot of things. You know, uncomfortable with the news, uncomfortable with your body, uncomfortable with people around you, uncomfortable with aging, uncomfortable with, you know, children actually create discomfort. They may bring joy, but actually, you know, think of it. We were, you know, we were both children, and a lot of us raised children. And, you know, the suffering is due to the attachment, due to desire. And yet the thing the Buddha pointed out that he realized under the Bodhi tree is nirvana exists. That in a way, all this suffering was a dream he was in, that he made real. And... Yes. Hard to stay comfortable. But nirvana exists, and there is a place we can find that's what we're all looking for. The boundless heart that we're seeking that actually isn't affected by what is going on in the change. And then there's nirvana. And then the teaching of the Buddha is the Eightfold Path of what to practice. And it's very important to realize that as the essence of what we're all trying to do. And the Eightfold Path actually starts with right view. Can we look the right way? And this comes up for all of us. We all have difficulty in our training. And one of the things when you do a talk on like something like this, it's like, okay, saying let go to suffering, but the last thing I'm going to do is let go of everything. You know, I'm holding all this stuff. I have all these desires. The training is to first start with right view. How do we approach? So when something happens, we have all those wrong ways of turning, of looking, of reacting to what happens. Well, right view means we're first starting to look, okay, this is impermanence. This is the nature of, this is comes out of this desire. This comes out of this way of looking at it. And, you know, and then what actually will lead to solving this problem, this suffering, this discomfort? Think of all the unskillful ways we can approach whatever happens to us. And, you know, just like to see what good and evil is. You know, what do we do when we do wrong? You know, are we really willing to see right view that actually we're causing us and others to suffer? It's much less likely to want to seek it when you realize you're facing it and you kind of keep going, okay, this is not going to help the situation. And that's why one aspect of right view is to see wherever they say in Buddhism, wherever you look, you should see impermanence, anicca. Nothing is really solid. And when we suffer and when we have desire, things get really solid. They solidify in our heart. They solidify in our view. And we make it very real and very concrete. Like, this person's a problem and it's just a passing thing. You know, this body is a problem. This ache is a problem. You know, and there's a saying I like that, you know, that it's been said in Buddhism, If there's no talk of impermanence, it is not the speech that will lead to wisdom. That to be wise, you have to actually see that there's nothing solid there. And we're making a problem by solidifying our problems. Solidifying, when we don't know, you know, and the other thing is that the word of the wise is everything is uncertain. So whatever happens, you don't know what it means. You know, the bad turns good, the good turns bad. It's like there's an old story in Buddhism where somebody has a child that gets an injury, and everybody goes, oh, how awful that is. And then they go, then everybody gets drafted into the military. Oh, you're so lucky, because your son, you know, and it keeps rotating. Like the what seemed to be good, bad turns good, and what turns good actually turns bad, because you don't actually know in the end what it means. Something seems to break your heart and actually points you to what you really need to do, and you don't know. You know, when you think you know what it means, stock market goes down, you don't know what it means in the long run. You know, you don't know what you'll need, what will happen. It's all uncertain. You don't know what's going to happen to whoever you're with tomorrow. You don't know what's going to happen to you tomorrow. It's all uncertain. It's all impermanent. In all wisdoms, you know, and in practice, and in training the Buddha way, the image I always like is they'll say that people are generally getting intoxicated. And I like using intoxication because it's a way we get lost and drunk in a way on our desires and fears. How they just fill us. And it's like the whole world. Think of how we do it with other people. It's like this huge, you know, this anger, this fear, this strong feeling. And it's, you know, and just the kind of the practice of the Buddha under the Bodhi tree was he felt the scriptures, you know, he described that he felt approached by all his desires. You know, like beautiful maidens kind of came to him in a very graphic way. Things that he wanted came to him. And he had to kind of sit there and say, nothing is there, even though it seemed to fill completely. And then all the fears came at him and he felt like he was attacked. And he just sat still, and they kind of say that all the arrows being shot at him turned into low flowers as he just sat there. You know, and he converted it by just being willing not to be moved. And we do that actually in ourselves. You think, well, how do you do it? You do it in, usually, we're not doing it like the Buddha did under the Bodhi tree, everything in one sitting. But we do it when the anger comes up, the fear comes up. The problems come up and we sit still. Nothing is really there. We can convert it into a flower. You know, we can convert the person we're having to, and we've actually done that at times. Think of it, we've usually all done it with anger. We're angry with somebody. And somehow we'll kind of have a meeting of the minds and suddenly you feel closer to the person than you actually did before. You know, you realize there's nothing there. I like this person. I really like this person. You know, and the arrow turns into a flower. You know, and we were actually kind of thinking, I can't stand this person. I mean, you have it in, you know, it's the classic romantic thing. You know, you fight and you make up. Because in a way, both are there. And we want to just let go of the anger part and just hold, you know, just realize the real thing is the connection, not the feeling of alienation. You know, that we all share the same Buddha heart. And, you know, just like when... And fear is a good example of how the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree and said, I will not be moved. And that is... Fear is a good example of how strong emotion that moves us. Think of how overwhelming it can be to be scared. And... Yet the place to react to it is actually not the solution. The place it arises in our heart is a place it'll be solved if we're willing to sit still. because there's really nothing there. It's just the self getting intoxicated on what it doesn't want, and it's scared. You know, the place of no fear is right there, sitting in the heart of the fear. And it's important. And as we react to it, we make it more. It's like a wheel that we turn faster and faster. And if we sit still, it starts, the uncertain and the impermanent nature of it appears. And we realize it's all there. You know, just like when you look at something, whatever you look at, you know, there's a saying of Nagarjuna. If one sees everything as impermanent, one will see everything as Buddha. You know, it's like you look, an image Ajahn Chah used to like using is you look at a glass, you break the glass, you feel like you've lost something. The glass was always broken. It was always, you know, the nature of the glass is it's going to break. When you look at it, just realize, just like the nature of Pi is that with luck he'll get to be old. You know, that's the nature. And actually, no matter what he does, you know, he'll dissolve into fourth, into what they say in Buddhism, we'll all dissolve into earth, water, wind, and fire. And that'll happen to all of us. You know, so nothing is special. You know, you do your best and you love the being, but you realize it's just earth, water, wind, and fire coming together and will come apart. And the real thing that the real, his real heart, my real heart, all real hearts are the Buddha heart. And if we realize that, we can be free of the fear. And when we realize it in something, we free ourselves from that something. And training isn't, how do I get to sit under the Bodhi tree and be completely free? The training is, how do I free this little bit of karma, this fear, this desire, this ill will, this way I get intoxicated, this way I get lost. And if we just have fear and we just sit still with the fear, and this is true of anything we experience, we sit still with it, it will burn out, get exhausted like a wheel that keeps turning. You know, it'll slow down. And it'll stop and you'll realize there's nothing there. But think of how we keep them all turning. You know, it's like, think of how worry keeps the fear revolving. You can go through the whole day turning the wheel of worry and keeping the fear alive. Turning the wheel of, I don't want this to be happening. And the freedom in Buddhism comes from the freedom of seeing everything is impermanent. Seeing that everything is uncertain. And we're dreaming when we think it's not. You know, just like this floor could collapse, but more likely the earthquake could happen. And think of it. You're going to have to be somewhere in an earthquake. This is a good place to be. Just like if you have to die, it's not a bad place. You know, and all of freedom comes, freedom from fear, freedom comes in Buddhism from everything, from just seeing clearly. The nice thing about Buddhism, all you have to do is stop getting intoxicated, and everything is the Buddha. There's no problem. There's nothing solid getting in our way. There's nothing solid anywhere. There's no obstacle. And when we make an obstacle, we need right view, and then right thought, you know, right speech, you know, right effort, you know, right mindfulness, you know, the Eightfold Path to kind of, okay, how do I deal with this? You know, and if we don't have equanimity, if we're not at peace, if we're not content, that gives us a good reason. Whatever the circumstances is, what are we doing? What is our heart doing that's making this problem? You know, if we have aversion, what are we doing? If we have if we're attracted? How are we getting intoxicated? God, I'm a mess. What are we intoxicated? You know, comes up, that person's a mess. Don't make a problem out of whatever it is. Its source goes in your mind and heart. You've created the problem. Sit still. Let it dissolve. There's no solid problem. It just meant, okay, I'm doing this. There's nothing solid there. Whatever you're doing wrong, you can do right. Whatever it is, all you have to do is stop. You know, it's like saying, how do I stop worrying? You know, just sit still. Why are you... See what's causing, you know, seeing what are you doing? You know, just like the Buddha went out himself when he recognized that there was old age, disease, and death. Universal truths, don't be shocked. You know, one of the great lines I love that is so universal is when people are old, they go, I don't know how I got here. You know, like, how did this happen? You know, I mean, I used to be young. You know, and I mean, they're sincere. It's almost like, because in your head, you're not this old being. You know, it's like, I don't, you know, my mind isn't old in that sense. You know, I don't feel that. But I look, this body, you know, my body's not what it once was. And that's kind of a key Dharma teaching. Maybe we have to take the cat out too. See, whoever Robin's around. Kind of, you know, that's why all the opposites, you know, gain and loss, fame and disgrace, praise and blame, happiness and unhappiness. You know, you see them all as impermanent. It's like, okay, somebody praises me, it means somebody's going to blame me too. It's going to come, you know, gain and loss. You know, we can all see, you know, stock market went up, stock market goes down. It'll keep going. Gain and loss is going to keep happening. Whatever it is, it's going to keep going. You recognize them as impermanent, as not the important thing. You haven't lost anything. You know, there's nothing really happening there. And it's the nice kind of Buddhism, unlike some religions, what the Buddha faced, his everyday life and koan is your everyday life. You know, it's not like there's a difference between us and the Buddha. He did a better job, just like some of us do better jobs than others, but we're all doing the same. It's the same stuff. You read what he faced under the Bodhi tree. You all are facing that. You know, and you all can solve it to the degree that you put your hearts into solving it. You know, will you have the complete enlightenment of the Buddha? Unlikely, but that's not the point. Do you want to solve? You can solve the fear that you when you confront it. You can solve the worry. You can solve the aversion, you can solve the boredom, the restlessness, the whatever it is. It's all there in your heart and you can solve it there. You know, and you know, anything we hold on to, you know, that we become attached to, you know, becomes birth and death, becomes a life that we're both grasping the life of. It's the becoming. It's how we come into existence as we grasp it. You know, and it's... And birth and death are happening right now in the present to whatever we grasp and want to become something. Just like you can get caught up in a dream of, I'm going to do this. Not that it's wrong to do whatever you're doing, but you're getting, it's the attachment to it. You know, just like I can remember, you know, because it's very concrete when I was doing construction, I would just get caught up in, I'm making this. You know, and then it doesn't go out the way I want. You know, I remember using a story where I built something and then it ended up it had to come down. I built it. And it wasn't what was wanted, and it had to come down, and it's like, no! I just put all this time, effort, that was me. I was going to look at that and think, I built that. And then suddenly, you know, and it's like the famous Dharma teaching of Milarepa, who had killed people. His parents, his family had been abused in Tibet. So to get back at them, he actually learned sorcery and killed some of the people who had done wrong. So when he went to study Buddhism under Marpa, Marpa actually said, this fellow needs to do, he actually did, really needs to show deep sincerity if he's going to deal with this karma. And the famous story of Marpa is he was told, build a house to prove your worthiness to be my disciple. He built the house for a year, and then Marpa comes by and said, it's on the wrong spot, take it down and put it up there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and this happened one more time and one more time, that Marpa would just come by and say, no, that's not what I want. And he had to do that. And it's funny, Marpa's, you know, to kind of show his sincerity. And then he became, you know, one of the great saints, you know, that, you know, in Tibetan Buddhism. One of the famous books is The 100,000 Songs of Milarepa, because he wrote these endless poems that have become sort of the standard part of Tibetan culture. And and whenever we think of things that we possess, own, they're conventions. They're not reality. I mean, it's like, this is my robe, but it's a convention. It's stuff coming together, and it's not really mine. And we have to use the conventions, just like you have desire. There's no problem in the fact that when you're hungry, you eat. When you're tired, you sleep. You know, when you need something, you know, you need a retirement. You know, it's reasonable. Wow, I should have faith. I shouldn't deal with, when I retire, it'll be okay. I'll be in the hands of the Buddha. No. You know, you kind of prepare. You know, you take care of it, but you kind of just try not to be attached to it, not make it really something you're grasping hard. You just realize, okay, this is just like having food in the cupboard. You know, it's good to do, but if it disappears, somehow we'll deal with it. You know, I'll work, you know, maybe I'll be in good health and I can work till 85, you know. Is that even a bad thing? You know, it's like the idea in our culture, you know, you should be able to stop working. Well, actually, if you're in good shape, why? What's wrong with working? I remember one of the monks said, I guess we don't ever retire, do we? And then the other person said, I guess we don't ever really. There's no such thing as retired. You know, it's like you just do what you can. And, you know, we'll probably, I'm sure, 20 years from now, I'll be doing a little less than I'm doing now, I hope. I assume. But it is what it is. If I can still do it, I can't complain if I'm, you know, doing the same amount or 30 years from now. I don't think I'll be around 40 years from now, so. And in a way, the self-experiencing and getting caught up in happiness and unhappiness is really birth and death. You're making something when you grasp it and you're, you know, when you get caught up in it. It's a birth and death of a defilement. And the mind of the training that we're trying to do is to stay wherever we are and try to see clearly what is it that's going on right now. Often a lot of images of Buddhism and the practice that we can do in this very practice is in a way just want to be in a fog. You know, meditation can be a way of escaping, of not seeing what's going on. And it doesn't work. You know, you have to actually see, what are we actually doing? When we suffer, where is it coming from? You know, when we sit still, we're not. That's why we don't grasp after the thoughts. We don't push them away. The thoughts popping up, I'm going to show you. Oh, hell, I can think of the dream. I actually had dreams last night about today. You know, I could see, God, the potluck went awful. And literally, I realized, that's anxiety, kid. It's like, you know, just kind of just realizing, you know, that I forgot, you know, just the way the self gets caught up of, you know, which I can, you know, I suddenly realize, yeah, I'm getting caught up in this a little bit. which, you know, how do I relax and let go of it? You know, and that's why we can know desire and aversion arise. We can see fear. We can see the things and see how it arises in our heart and how they go away. Because that's actually, that's wisdom. You know, wisdom, if you're bored, what's bored? If you're scared, what is being scared? To have wisdom, you have to actually sit still and see, where is the problem coming from? If there's a problem, where are you creating it? You know, because we're creating the problem. It's not everything. The world is in our hearts. The world doesn't have any meaning unless we give it to it. It's like cars, things, they come together in our minds and in our hearts with attachment. They're not solid. You know, they're just elements coming together. And we say, wow, I like this car. I need to get there. I like this body. You know, I like beauty isn't, you know, the old expression, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Because actually, inherently, nothing is beautiful or not beautiful. It's just like, wow, I like. You know, it's like, I always like a line of a famous model who, when they said, what do you attribute your success to? And I was like, she just smiled and said, my inner beauty. And then she laughed, you know, making a, you know, because she was making a joke. She said, well, all it is I'm symmetrical. You know, that's all. People think it's something, you know, kind of this great mystery. And it's just, she says, when you break it down, I have, you know, pretty, my face is almost perfect symmetry. You know, and you kind of think, you know, everything's perfectly balanced in the right proportion, the proportions that we like. It's just like our figurehead, you know, just, you know, fat and where it's supposed to be fat, no fat where it's not supposed to be fat, you know, which isn't kind of like we give it mystical importance, but it's like just, and, you know, we're conditioned to like some things, you know, just like we, due to the way we look at things, certain colors, you know, just like colors have no inherent meaning. It's just the way we perceive them. You know, just like somebody was even kind of talking about, listening to somebody talking about music, where somebody was talking about perfect pitch, that whenever he hears anything, it's like a horn goes off and he can go, that's a B flat, that's a C. And wherever he goes, all the sounds, his mind registers immediately as notes. And he can hear. And actually, a lot of most good percentage of musical geniuses can do that because everything, you know, your brain just picks it up. Well, I just hear, you know, none of that. I mean, I have trouble even singing on key, so. But, and the person said, and I remember listening, and somebody said to the person, isn't that all arbitrary? There's no such thing as a B plus or a C minus in the real world. It's, he said, but there's no color in the real world either. There's no such thing as brown, blue, black. It's all convention that we, you know, that colors are. You know, there's no, you know, we perceive it and kind of label it as something, and there is a perception of it, but it's not like there's a solid line between anything. And because we all share the conventions, because we all have better color vision and pitch, you know, we can all say, oh, that's, you know, and you can kind of get into subtle, like the Inuit who would have 28 words for snow or something like that, or white, because they're in a landscape like that. And the activities of, like, just the opposites, happiness, unhappiness, gain, loss, fame, disgrace, these keep arising all the time because of the way the world is. There's nothing, you just know them for what they are. It's like being hungry, being tired, you know, it's the nature of it. There's no deep, you know, you sit still, nothing's really happening. It's just the way the world is. You know, it's just getting caught up in those things, which is the way we suffer. Then the world weighs us down. And that's why one of the signs of doing practice is things get lighter. You're less bound. Most of us would like to be absolutely free. But instead, if you practice, if you really think about it, you'll often feel lighter than before you practice. You know, less weight, you know, by things. And that's also why if you're not practicing, life gets very confusing. Because it's funny, the meanings don't correspond to what we want them to mean. So people are always going, why is this happening? You know, without seeing, it's all in their own heart. And they're the ones who are creating the confusion. It's like, why are people selfish? Duh. Look at yourself. You know, why is there desire? Look at yourself. Why is there fear? Look at yourself. You know, and the Buddha had a line, the Buddhist way, following the path, destroys the world and frees us. And the world is in our minds. By clinging to things and avoiding things, we make the world, and it starts dissolving when we stop grasping it. You know, just like seeing what you work at and realize it's not a big deal. It starts dissolving its importance. Think how important it can get. You know, hell, the potluck can be important. You know, this talk can be important. You know, I realize I can make anything important. Because I was thinking, I'm going to have all these people. I should give a good talk. And I realized. It's not that we're out of the opposites. It's when we aware, when we experience it, we realize that's what's happening. We're just getting caught up in it. And okay. And then we can look and see there's a way to free ourselves from this problem. And that's the key in training, to see that when things come up, there's a way out. And we can do it. When I talk to people, it's like, I know I can do it, but it's going to be really hard. And unfortunately, it's really hard. You know, this is difficult to do. If you're scared of something, it's really hard. And I know it's really hard. Too many people in this room. Little cat out there. It's like, I'm not used to this. This is my room. Where's my bed? And in a way, we want to be deluded. You know, we want to just, you know, I mean, we're comfortable being intoxicated with something. You know, like, I want to get caught up in this. It's sort of fun to lose myself in this. Except the trouble is it doesn't keep working. Think of the way probably everybody in this room has gotten lost in work at times. Like, all that matters is how I'm doing this. And really, does it work, you know, in the end? I mean, it may work for the work, but does it work for your life? Look at your heart, how your heart's feeling. Often you come home and where's your heart? You know, you stop working. I've actually met people who had trouble not working. In fact, my father was amazed that my father was a New York City cab driver. He said he actually would meet people who, like, he met one cab driver who said, he's talking to my father, he says, well, what do you do when you're not working? And he was serious. You know, he had trouble figuring out, what do you do when you're not working? And you think, this is driving a cab. You know, for a good percentage of humanity, this is hell. I have to drive in New York City traffic all day long. I mean, that rate's very low on my list of life. Of realms I'd like to be in. Actually, it's lots of jobs I would like less than that. But still, it's not high on my list of jobs. But that's the way you can be. And the way the world teaches us, you know, it tells us this body is mine. It's just a body. These problems are mine. They're just problems. You know, the Buddha is saying nothing is substantial. Nothing is ours. If we make it ours, we will suffer. And we don't kind of, how do I get out of being me? You let go of all the little pieces that build the self. You know, you just let go, okay, that's some pride. Nothing there. There's nothing really special, even though I'm good at this. I'm awful at this. Nothing special there. God, I have something. It's like people will have something go wrong with them, and a very normal experience we can have is that we'll go around wondering, how come everybody's just living normally? When I had this severe health problem, or somebody just died, and they're just going around like nothing's happening. And of course for them nothing is happening, even if you tell them, wow, my spouse just died, or this person just died. To them it's, oh, death. That's pretty normal. But my death. And that shows you, that points out the delusion, we're all philosophical about it, except when it's me, my suffering. And when I'm suffering, I just have to remind myself, okay, what's going on here? And that's why, in a way, we're trying to have mindfulness so we can see the letting go. We have to kind of see. The training is, can we let go of what is arising in our hearts and minds as we go through the day, the years? And just work at things. You find training is not saying, how can I let go of everything? Finding the big pieces. I've even noticed that a practice I find helpful is just reflecting at the end of the day. What did I need to let go of today that I'm having trouble with? Where's my problems coming from? And just kind of focusing on the big piece currently that I'm dealing with. Like this fear, this desire, this mistake, this way I've been avoiding doing, something I need to be doing, kind of something I'm avoiding, something I'm not doing, and just kind of focusing, okay, how do I let go of what's getting in the way of just being whole with this? Anyway, it gets warm in this room with all these little, remember somebody saying 50 watts per person. So we have a couple here, a couple fairly big heaters going. We ran up this many bodies. Anyway, anybody have any comments? I know it's a little hard in such a big group. Yeah?
That was wonderful. Thank you.
Sure. I mean, I like that type of comment.
That's all I have.
And you all like that?
Yeah. Speaking of praise and blame, I had a question about praise and blame, because you brought up the four sets of opposites.
Yeah. They're often, in Buddhism, they're often called the eight worldly dharmas, kind of the four opposites, the four sets of opposites.
The eight great distractions.
Or the eight great distractions.
Yeah, I find it helpful to think of them as distractions.
Yeah, that's another way of, What about?
Well, the praise and blame was the one I was thinking about during your talk, because you mentioned somebody's going to, praises you and it feels good, and you know that you're going to get blamed eventually also, maybe even by the same person or somebody else, and how that can pull you out of meditation. But I even sometimes think of I think I have a compliment for somebody, but I don't want to distract them, so I'm not going to give that compliment, And I actually think about that. I even had an interaction recently where I complimented somebody, and I could see they were totally distracted by it, and then I made a joke about, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to bring up the arising of opposites for you by compliment. And the person laughed and thought, yeah, I'm being distracted. And we actually were able to have the compliment but still bring ourselves back to something else and not have this carry us off.
Well, one thing about all those things is they're actually, no matter what you do, they arise. So if they arise naturally, like if somebody does something nice, I think I'm often thanking people, trying to be nice and complimentary a lot of the time, just because it's a help to, you know, it's a help. It's just not to get caught up in it. Just like, you know, if you do anything, like if you work for somebody, occasionally you'll get things wrong. And, you know, okay, I blew something. And, you know, that's the nature of it. Just, you know, if you're going to gain and loss, there's nothing wrong, you know, like stock market goes up 2,000 points in the next 3 weeks. Great. Goes down 2,000, you know what I mean? It's like, mm-hmm. I'm sure it's nice if it goes up. Praise is nice. You know, just like a good example of the opposites is, we'll have is, you know, you can create a distraction. Think of the potluck. You know, greed's going to arise.
It's brewing.
You know, there's eight, you know, 6 or 8 different cakes and pies. You know, we have a dozen main dishes. It's like, okay, all these different things to eat, drink. We don't avoid, okay, let's not have anything. Because it'll create thing. Can we deal with it? And then, you know, and I've actually had it where suddenly we had this whole thing happen, something like this, and suddenly there was something going wrong and I had to miss the whole, you know, thing, and I just have to be willing, okay, that's that. And I can even remember, even the way we can be absurd. One of my favorite ones of how greed was strange was at the Abbey, we would, you know, kind of have these structured, and there would be a tea with treats or something at the Abbey, and, you know, big thing there, some really nice something at tea. And I'd suddenly at my work would kind of, something would come up, and I'd, God, I have to go do something. And it happened actually fairly regularly for me because I was guest master, so something would happen, and I would have to run off or do something, and I'd miss the tea. And I'd be going around, oh.
So less.
Poor me. And the absurd thing was, is there was a kind of a thing when I was guest masters, people were always giving me stuff. So I actually had an office with a drawer full of stuff that I worked really hard at not eating. Because otherwise I'd be, you know, and people even would come up there when they were depressed, they would come by, can I have a piece of chocolate kid, right, or a thing or something? Because I would always have a drawer full of stuff because people were very nice and would often show up and give me something. And you know, and some of it I would pass on to the kitchen, but some I would keep for whatever purposes we had, you know, give to other people who I worked with and even the lay people something when, you know, I had tea with them. But, and I kind of think it's absurd. I don't want to eat my stuff because I feel like, you know, it's like free karma for me to eat what's given at the tea. And it's just the way greed gets twisted up, and it's like it doesn't make any sense, which is often true of almost all the stuff when we look at it, the praise and blame, all the stuff doesn't really make sense when we really let go and look clearly at what's going on. But we get caught up in it, and just to realize it doesn't matter. You know, you want to just do what's good. And to say something nice to somebody is often going to help, you know, is, you know, just like gain. I want, you know, all of you come, you know, going to do something I think that'll generate a loss. I'll try to point you to gaining, not losing, you know, having pleasure rather than pain. All those opposites. We are on a practical level trying to get the goods, you know, the one we like out of the opposites. And that's just normal daily life. I want pleasure, not pain. One of my problems is I get it wrong. But, you know, so I have that long history as a masochist. No. but we get it wrong sometimes. You know, we don't want to get caught up in it. We want to be at peace with, oh, that is, now I'm eating something that I don't enjoy. Why is that a problem? You know, now I'm having to put up with something I don't want to put up with. The image I always like giving is, because a number of people would say that's the hardest thing they had at training at the Abbey, was watching bad TV shows at tea. And you realize, why is that so painful? It's just, you know, the self saying, this isn't training. But it was training. You know, you were asked to watch You know, I remember there was a cartoon that Reverend Master G used, like, Felix the Cat. I can still sing it. Felix the Cat. Wonderful cat.
Nice training.
A lot of that, for some reason, Reverend Master G liked it, and it just irritated. You know, most of us didn't like Felix the Cat. We just sat there and watched Felix the Cat. And it's, you know, and you realize, what's the difference? It's just... You're just not enjoying it. You know, what's the big deal? It's to sit still with that. Actually, you can meditate with that. The same thing as you can meditate. Be still and open and realize there's not a problem in a situation. You're with people you don't like being around. Somebody who's opinionated or talkative, and you're finding, oh, God, I want to listen to all this stuff. What's the problem? It's just stuff. What are you taking into your heart? You know, when it, and that's what the opposites point in. Are you taking praise or blame into your heart? Or right now, what's real is the Buddha, the heart of Buddha is here. Can I sit still and realize that's what's important? You know, not the praise and the blame, not the pleasure, pain, not the comfort, discomfort. My knees hurt, so sit still. You know, the heart can be filled with Buddha even though your knees hurt. And that's the reality that the Buddha found under the Bodhi tree. And that's right view. This is going to make an interesting take if I put it. He says things and people are screaming.
It's better than snoring like Reverend Master.
Yeah, Reverend Master. It took, you know, it took us for years. Reverend Master Jiyu would make, let's do all her tapes. And she would have her bulldog sitting at her feet who would fall asleep. And being a bulldog, they have, like, no breathing. You know, the whole nose means they almost can't breathe, literally. And they snore. So you'd hear this really loud snoring. And for a while, we were actually even selling the tapes without even putting a thing on it until we finally realized that we should put on the tape. The snoring is her pet bulldog. Because you wonder, how can they be snoring that loud? It's like somebody right next to her is and it's on endless tapes. But, and the funny thing is, we didn't even do anything for a while. So we would be actually circulating the tapes, selling them in the shop. And people just hear, you know, so like, really loud. You know, because she even had two bulldogs for a while, and both sit there, snoring on different patterns. And Winstina, a bulldog. Anyway, it's probably, I think I'll, in the talk, nice to, you know, it actually works to do this. I've often done this a little closer to